Welcome to the PC Gamer Podcast. This is episode 78 for the week of April 9th, 2007. Hello from wherever you are. Welcome to this week's edition of the PC Gamer Podcast. Joining me today, this is Norm the intern, by the way, but joining me today is our senior associate editor, Dan Stapleton.
Hello.
Our hardware editor, Logan Decker.
Howdy.
Backspace columnist, Gary Widow.
Hello.
And Jeremy Williams, our producer.
Hey, everybody.
Let's jump right into news. We actually have an interview coming up later today, so stay tuned for that. We're going to interview Mark DeForest, who's the lead designer at S2 Games for Savage 2. Stay tuned for that. But in the news, the Army seems to be they're back in the gaming news, and this time they're not developing a game, but they're putting all their money into a gaming tournament. It's the GGL, and they're putting $2 million to sponsor the Global Gaming League. That's a lot of money, right, Logan?
That's a hell of a lot of money. I mean,
Logan is our money quantity expert. Logan, how much money
I'm the
is
expert witness on money.
Would you say that's more than $1 million or less?
Sorry. $2 million would buy a lot of cat litter. I think it's a great way for the Army to reach out to, you know, to young people and be able to say, hey, here we are while, throwing some money at something they love to do, you know?
Yeah, why be satisfied getting killed in a video game when you could get killed for real?
Oh.
That's a cheap shot, you know? I mean, it's like the Army does not choose the wars they fight, you know? If you don't like the wars, then go after the politicians, go after Congress, go after the president, you know? But the Army does a great job getting its message across.
Well, okay, this is taxpayers' money, of course, right? And was there a lot of controversy when America's Army was being developed? I don't know if they ever released the production cost for that, but I think they must have spent a lot of money on that. But this is a totally different thing. This is them putting cash toward a gaming tournament. And
well, this
for
is their
government entity,
budget.
That's kind of...
But, yeah, you know, the idea is exactly the same as, like, you know... the Adidas deodorant sponsoring a competition. You know, they're just getting their name out there and letting people know, hey, we're out here. We get, you know, what you're into, and, you know,
it does make perfect sense. I mean, the target market for, you know, Army recruitment, obviously, you know, is kids who are hopefully, you know, kind of tech savvy and smart and like guns. And, you know, that, you know, and the idea of shooting things, and that obviously all fits into the gamer mindset. There's a TV ad running right now, actually, where, I don't know if you've seen it, but there's like two guys on the couch at home playing a kind of a fictionalized Ghost Recon type game on their console or whatever. And, you know, one of the soldiers in the game kind of taps on the screen and says, you know, wouldn't you rather be doing this for real? And, you know, it's like, join the Army.
Yeah, there does seem to be a big section of our readership that's in the Army. I get any time we make a reference to a gun in a game that, you know, we get like a model number wrong or something, the letters just pour in to correct us. So
yeah, we do.
So our readers have a very good knowledge of firearms, and a lot of people we get pictures sent in from people reading their PC Gamers on Humvees in Iraq. So it is a lot of our readership. So there seems to be a lot of, a big cross-section of interest between the Army and games. Also, wow. This is a much better expenditure of the Army's money than, you know, Army of One ads, I think.
I agree.
Yeah, I'm going to sleep better tonight knowing that some of my tax dollars are going toward the salary of some gaming superstar at the GGL.
As opposed to, you know, having a little computer-generated knight turn into a marine or something.
Yeah, I don't know where that one
That was weird.
That's the Navy's.
Yeah, very weird. This is much better.
I'm thinking about this as a parent's point of view, and I don't know how I would feel if I had a 14-year-old kid going off to a gaming tournament that was sponsored by the Army.
Well, I mean, it depends on how you feel about the Army, but I...
Well, it depends how you feel about your kid going off to war, I think is what it comes down to.
Well, staying away from the topic of the war, I mean, there's nothing wrong with military service.
No, so, absolutely.
So we certainly, you know, don't want to imply that there is.
I think kids should know that, that the military is an option. It's an honorable option. It's a great option for a lot of people. Like I said before, if you got a problem with the war, you know, you take it up with Congress or the president.
But I agree with that, Logan, but the two things aren't separable in a time of war. You know, it's I agree. I think military service is a great thing. But you know, now we live in an age where joining the army now is considerably more dangerous than it might be at another time. So
well, yeah,
you know, I'm sure a lot of people factor that in.
From Jeremy's perspective as a parent, you know, you got to sit down and you talk to your kids about the reality that you won't see in a promotion. You know, that you don't see in a commercial that looks all exciting and, you know, adventurous, but doesn't present the danger so much.
And it turns out you don't get to be Sam Fisher.
What? What? You don't get the fifth freedom.
But my point is, this isn't an act of philanthropy on that, you know, on the part of the army.
This is
sort of preying on young kids who are very impressionable.
I wouldn't say praying.
In the same way that any advertiser would prey on young people, this is the same thing. This is them trying to get into their heads.
It's no different to them taking out TV advertising or doing any of the things that they need to do to attract, you know, the demographic they need to attract.
Yeah, it is a recruitment tool, you know. I remember early on I thought it was a big misstep for them, for the Army to say that America's Army wasn't a recruitment tool. Come on, guys. You know, it was a recruitment tool, and there's nothing wrong with that. It was a really good one. It told me a lot more about, you know, what the military is and what their values are than that ridiculous commercial ever did.
I wonder about the demographic a little bit, though. It's while it's true that the, you know, the gamers are likely to be in the right age, you know, kind of in their teens, late teens, you know, just when you're coming, you know, viable to become an army recruit, and you probably are quite smart about computers and technical things. You're also quite likely as a gamer to be quite out of shape and quite lazy and a bit pudgy. And I really can't imagine, you know, a subset of people who would be more culture shocked to suddenly kind of be, you know, being kicked out of their bed at 5 o'clock in the morning to be shouted at by a drill sergeant for not having a tidy footlocker than, you know, your average, you know, guy who normally has been sitting on a couch eating Fritos and playing Ghost Recon for the last couple of years. That would be a big culture shock.
Yeah, I mean, I used to tell the Army recruiters when they called me when I was that age that, you know, it was not in the interest of national security to wake me up at 5 a.m. and give me a gun. It just would not go over well.
Apparently, if you go to the Sims 2 website, there's a little teaser for four different Visa credit cards that will be released that have designs inspired by the game. And I don't know if this is the first time we've seen gaming, you know, on credit cards, but it seems to be moving more toward, you know, gaming.
It has got to be the first.
I don't know about that. I think there might have been, like, some Super Mario credit cards a while back.
But see, this one is different in that if you don't keep charging on this card, your Sims will die. All right, no, okay, folks, that wasn't true. But it would be cool if it was.
Yeah, I mean, is this just like a Sims graphic on the card, or do you get, like, Sims points or something for every dollar you spend?
There should be at least some type of in-game tie-in where, you know, the more dollars you spend in real life, the more, what is it, the simoleons you get?
Unfortunately, we don't know yet.
That would be kind of pointless.
That's
though,
also
just put in
perfect marketing on the credit card company's part, because people who play The Sims, they're consumers. They like to buy things within The Sims game.
And
so,
we know they have addictive personalities.
I could definitely see this catching on, actually. I mean, if you think about it, you know, it kind of in the console space as well, you know, you could have like an Xbox card where, you know, every dollar you spend, maybe you get like a gamer point that you can spend in their online marketplace or something.
Right.
Just the same, just like Air Miles, but for gamers, really.
So, have they announced if this Sims card actually has any added benefits like that?
They haven't.
Not yet.
But for fans of The Sims, you know, go check it out, and you too could be shopping with a Sims Visa card.
Usually it does, though, isn't it? Like, if you have, like, your, you know, kind of college alumni credit card or something, then, you know, money gets given to that fund, or, you know, an airline card, you get Air Miles. Usually there is some, you know, actual reason beyond just the pretty design on the card for you to have that particular card.
Yeah, I'm kind of surprised they haven't put out like credit cards for MMOs to maybe earn more time on your MMO if you spend money that way, or, you know, that'd be a, you know, compelling thing for a lot of World of Warcraft users. It's like, you know, get 1,000 points on your credit card and get a free month, you know.
Yeah.
Or a free pet.
Yeah.
Or it's a new way to get your hot coffee.
You know, I was changing a light bulb yesterday, and I realized that for the past 5 years, I've been traumatized because my Sim died changing a light bulb.
Oh!
And every time I go to do it, I get scared because of that.
Did you get electrocuted or something?
Yeah. Just completely out of the blue. And I had been,
I didn't know you could have random deaths like that. That's really sad.
They can catch on fire if you don't, especially if you don't have a fire alarm.
Jeremy, I gotta say, that is probably the most moving thing I've heard on our podcast in years.
My question is, how many podcast producers does it take to change a light bulb?
Right.
Did you have to call in backup?
For PC gamers and Xbox 360 gamers, the expansion, long-awaited expansion to Oblivion, our RPG game of the year last year, came out a couple weeks ago. But now, things might not be looking so good because there appears to be a critical bug in the game. The critical bug, not everyone's getting it apparently, but people on forums are saying that the bug, which ends the game effectively, appears both in the 360 and PC versions and hasn't been patched yet?
No, it's apparently a scripting problem. Has to do with like identification numbers for items in the game. Like there's a certain number of items in the game, and then stuff would start disappearing and then crash. I don't know how this kind of thing would get past their QA. I mean, if it seems to be affecting both 360 and PC, I mean, it's not like they allocated too much QA to the 360 team or something like that.
According to this story, though, it's a bug that only becomes apparent after you've been playing the game for a very, very long time, like 150 hours or something.
Yeah.
Right.
And but depending on how many frames are rendered.
Yeah, it's like...
I mean, I'm not suggesting people won't be playing the game for that long. I certainly know people that have put that kind of time into it.
Oh, yeah, I'd probably be pushing, you know, at least a third of that by now if I hadn't been on vacation last week.
And that would be, I mean, and that's the worst thing, isn't it? You know, to discover a bug that serious when you're that deeply invested in the game.
Oh, yeah, especially if the patch they eventually put out to fix it kills your save.
I can't believe they would do that.
Oh.
It does sound like a pretty bad bug, though.
Yeah,
but do you think this is like the beginning of a trend of, you know, buggier games being released for both console and PC? I mean, on the PC side, we almost expect patches to come out for games to fix bugs that developers just don't have time to fix or don't notice the first time through QA. But on the console side, you know, more consistently now we're seeing patches through Xbox Live, but for people who don't have an internet connection, sucks for them, I guess.
I don't think it's necessarily a good or a bad thing in itself. It really depends on the attitude that you bring to it. Like you say, PC gamers have been living with this now for many years as just a fact of life. On the console side, it's one of the things that the console guys have kind of been holding over PC people, saying, well, when our games are released, they're always finished, and, you know, not really any such thing as a bug on a console, and to a large extent that's been true. But now that we're in the world of consoles being as connected and as online as PCs are, on the one hand, it's great because it allows you to add extra features and continue to evolve the game after release. But I do think that, you know, if you come to it as a developer with a different attitude, it's the old, well, we've got to get it out, and, you know, we can always patch it. In the old days of consoles, when there wasn't the opportunity to do that, they would just have to wait and get it right because they couldn't be seen to release a buggy game, and then there'd be no recourse to fix it. But now that you can patch these games easily, I think you are going to see more examples of this.
Of course, in the old days of consoles, the games weren't nearly as complex either. So it's like the consoles now are the 360 and the PS3 are basically PCs anyway. So they're you know, doing the same heavy lifting. And the only real benefit anymore of developing for consoles is not having to account for different hardware.
Yeah,
which is still a big benefit.
Well, I mean, you see, I mean, that is, don't underestimate that benefit. That's a pretty big one.
Yeah, it's huge. Actually.
Absolutely, yeah.
It's an advantage and it's a curse because they're stuck without hardware until the next generation comes out. Well, we can upgrade to our 8800s and to our DirectX 10 and have nothing to play but tech demos. God, I love tech demos.
Norm's just pissy because you got Vista.
I finally got Vista and an 8800, and all I can do is watch tech demos.
from
they're
NVIDIA.
Nice tech demos. They're awesome tech demos.
I'm so glad that I didn't install Vista now. That disk is still sitting here, and I was like, I was always nervous about it, and now I'm just so happy that I didn't do it.
I'm doing okay. It's okay. I mean, it's not hurting anything. It's just not helping much right now. It will soon, but not.
Yeah, yeah, and you dual boot, right?
I do, but I've been living almost exclusively in Vista.
Oh, really? I'm the opposite. I turn on Vista when I want to try out Aero and the new functionality, but no, sticking with XP for now.
Apparently, there was a story. This isn't like an official Delicious thing or anything, but I was reading a couple of weeks ago. There was a story that PC manufacturers or PC wholesalers had said that the release of Vista didn't seem to have had any positive effects. Like, there was no uptick of PC sales the way that there traditionally is after a new Windows comes out. So mm-hmm. It doesn't seem like people are really responding to it yet.
Well, Microsoft released some sales figures. They said, you know, Vista is their fastest selling OS so far, but that includes all the OEM bundles. And you know, I think I did read some stuff about PC manufacturers having, you know, unprecedented number of people returning their you know, asking for older versions or asking for XP and just not liking Vista or not used to it, at least.
The figures that came out of the Microsoft hut were a little suspect. They said, what, 20 million since the release?
Yeah, exactly.
And what, they sell at most 3 million PCs a year?
It's all the corporate copies they sell. Like, you know, if they sell a license to a big company, that's for like 5,000 employees. But in reality,
I'd be very interested to see where those figures came from.
Switch over.
You guys think there's any chance that Vista won't take off?
No.
No, it's going to happen eventually. I think we're all waiting for Service Pack 1, because when the Vista did come out, it was missing a lot of the original stuff they planned for it, just because it has been delayed for so long. They just wanted it out. But, I mean, DirectX 10 is coming, like it or not. When the new video cards come out, the lower end models that have DirectX 10 support, you know, the 8600s, 8400s, whatever, and the ATI models, you know, they'll be cheaper and people will eventually adopt them.
When I first got my copy of Command & Conquer 3 in the mail the other day, I was looking at the system requirements, and there's like two sets of system requirements now, not just the regular minimum, you know, and recommended stuff, but, you know, there's a set of requirements, but then in parentheses after each line item, there's like an additional thing for Vista. So it's like, well, you need, you know, 512 megs of RAM, 1 gigabyte for Vista, and everything seems to be like the requirements are just that little bit higher if you're a Vista owner, and that just doesn't strike me as a good thing.
Well, I mean the OS you know, takes up more resources itself, and that's to be expected. XP took up a lot more than the 98 or ME, so you know it's just natural progression. You know, I don't think that they're doing it as well as they could have done. I don't think they were as ready as they should have been, but I don't think this is unprecedented in any way, shape, or form. So I'm not prepared to condemn them for it.
And it's by no means a bad OS. It's pretty swanky, and you know, I'm liking the features I am that do work with Vista. And also, there's that feature that gives you your computer a score. It takes a rating for every part that you have, and that's supposed to be this new standard for system requirements.
Yeah, I like how they've simplified the process there. And yeah, you're right. In a year or two, when you know systems are just running this thing without any hassle, then you know we won't even be having this kind of conversation. And then hopefully we'll also have things like achievements and gamer scores and live anywhere and all that stuff actually working.
That's coming
properly.
Early May. Coming early May, coming properly. You know, who knows when? But a game that doesn't work in Vista and that we've talked about in the past is Stalker, but now there's a different controversy with Stalker. It seems like some savvy tech guys went into the game files within Stalker, looked at some of the art assets, and realized that these are the same art assets that were in Doom 2 and or Doom 3 and Half-Life 2.
They suspect they are. There's a very strong resemblance, and it's still hypothetically possible that's not where they came from, but it's mm-hmm. unlikely.
Don't they share file names?
There's one that does share a file name, and that's like the smoking gun, so to speak.
Yeah, but it's unclear if those are used in the game if they're just placeholder. And THQ, I've been in contact with them. They still have no official comment on that. They are looking into it. But yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe that anyone would be that crazy.
I mean, it
just goes to show that, you know, even within the development process, you know, these people, developers are, they're real people. They're like, you know, They can make mistakes. And there was a whole controversy a couple of years ago when Far Cry came out, right? And there was something leaked out about developers using pirated software to develop Far Cry,
right.
Like a pirated version of Photoshop or some type of rendering software. And so that could have made the entire game illegal to play or to sell. But yeah, so as that story unfolds, we'll have more updates once THQ gives an official statement.
You remember when somebody delved into the Windows sounds and realized that some of them were made with a pirated copy of SoundForge?
Yeah.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah, it tags SoundForge tags a file with the name and registration code or something like that of the person who used it.
And it was like Leap Haxor.
Yeah, it was like a hacker group name.
That's great.
But, you know, it makes sense to me, you know, that if you were making a game and you said, okay, we need this kind of texture, that rather than, you know, having a text file or something, you would grab a texture from someplace else. Okay, it looks like this. And, you know, you've got thousands and thousands of textures in a game when you're making it, and you simply don't clean all the placeholders out. You know, I think it's as simple as that.
Yeah, it's until proven otherwise, I'm not giving the benefit of the doubt here and just assume that's what it is. Until somebody comes out and shows it in the game.
Bust.
Hello, my name is Chris Taylor of Gas Powered Games, and you're listening to the PC Gamer Podcast.
Well, if you have an extra $100 and some free time this summer, well, the first thing you should be doing is going to our Showdown Land. But if you have an extra $100 and are already going to Showdown, maybe you should consider BlizzCon. BlizzCon 2007 was just announced today. Last year was incredibly popular. This year it'll be in Southern California on August 3rd and 4th, and registration is $100. Is that a little too much?
I don't know. Considering what people are willing to pay for, like the collector's edition of Burning Crusade and the rabid quality of the WoW fan base, I don't think they're going to have any trouble filling that.
They also,
yeah, I think it's a case of what the market will bear. I think Blizzard, based on the first BlizzCon, probably know that this is going to be massively oversubscribed. There's, you know, however many people they can legally fit into the Anaheim Convention Center, there's going to be, you know, at least that many people that are more than willing to pay $100.
I mean, that's astounding to just, you know, for this company, you know, basically just for World of Warcraft, but I guess for Diablo or two and StarCraft and fans of those, but to pay $100 to meet developers and, you know, enter some tournaments and some cosplay contests.
Well, think about it, though. They've got, what, nearly 8 million players worldwide now, probably, to, you know, approaching 3 million here in the U.S. You know, let's assume that they can get, you know, 100 or 150,000. I'm pulling these numbers out of my ass here, but let's say they can get 100 or 150,000 people in and out of the Anaheim Convention Center over the course of, you know, 2 or 3 days. That's still only a very small fraction of the, it's like, what, one in out of every 20 or 25 people that actually play the game would even be able to go.
It still blows my mind, but
I think Blizzard. I gotta imagine they're still losing money on this, though, because there's no other sponsorship besides their own bank account.
Blizzard's not in the business of losing money.
I mean,
I don't think they know how to lose money.
You don't think this is them giving back because they have made so much money? I don't know.
No, I doubt.
I guess it's kind of like QuakeCon, but QuakeCon is free.
$100 per person, though. That's gonna foot quite a bit of the bill, I think.
Yeah. Yeah,
and they probably will be announcing sponsors. I'm sure, like, you know, Nvidia or someone, one of these people will jump in and co-sponsor it, because it is a big event. I'm actually glad they're doing it again, because it wasn't certain for a while there whether they were going to do it every year or even, you know, just do it again at all. But I'm glad that they're doing it now. I didn't get to go to the last one, but I know that everyone who went to the last one did have a really good time. It was a really huge event. So I'm going to try to go. I think it'll be fun. The weird thing is, Norman, since you mentioned QuakeCon, there's an overlap between BlizzCon and QuakeCon. They will be taking place on some of the same days.
Really?
So I'm not sure how much of an overlap there is between World of Warcraft type people and Quake World type people, but some of those people are going to have to make a choice, because you can't be, you know, you're going to have to, you've got one in California and another
and
one.
One's in Texas.
In Texas, and I believe it's like the 3rd to the 5th, is it?
Yeah, it's a direct overlap. Well,
yeah, it's the 3rd to the 5th of BlizzCon, and the 2nd to the 4th, I think, for for QuakeCon. So I think all but on one day, they're overlapping.
Wow.
Well, BlizzCon is actually just the third and fourth, not in the fifth.
Third and fourth, but then QuakeCon is what, the second to the fifth. So I guess you could do both if you wanted to fly around the country like a mad person. But it seems strange that there's so few of these specific fan base related conventions, and they've decided to schedule them both at the same time.
Yeah, thank heavens PeggleCon isn't until, what, late summer? So
that's right. That gives me a little extra time to work on my my Peggle costume.
Bjorn.
I'm still working on my Bjorn horn unicorn cosplay outfit.
These scheduling things do happen. I mean, last year we were unfortunate in that we got PAX on the same weekend as Showdown, but we fixed that this time. So
I am, by the way, if any of you guys are interested, I am still looking for someone who's willing to be the back end of Bjorn.
Oh, that's terrible. Well, at BlizzCon last year, everyone who went, I think, got also a Murloc card, which they could activate in-game, and those were selling for, I mean, ridiculous prices on eBay.
So there's going to be a goodie bag. You get a goodie bag, and they've not yet announced what will be in it. But, yeah,
slots will that bag have, guys?
I don't know. Probably be an 18-slot bag. Depends. If they make it out of Felcloth, it could be bigger.
Oh my!
But no, I imagine that there will be another exclusive pet, and I imagine that sadly some people will acquire that pet only to then sell it for a ridiculous markup on eBay.
You know, I'm not sure Blizzard is going to be doing any more exclusive pets like that, for that very reason. Too many people were selling them. They had some reservations. We were contacting them about possibly doing one for PC Gamer, and they didn't want to do it because they didn't want people selling them like that.
Wow. Well, then BlizzCon's still a good place to find out that your online girlfriend is a guy. We were talking about Vista and achievements earlier, and this week they announced the Halo 2 for Vista gaming achievements. So if achievements is something you're looking forward to for Live for Windows, the list is online. It's a pretty detailed list, but it gives, you know, anywhere ranging from 5 to 30 points for or 50 points for things that you can do in Halo 2. I can run through a couple of them, but it's best for you to just check it out online.
Are there there are some highlights in here, like there's an assassin one for if you melee an opponent from behind, and vigilante stop a killing spree of another player. So
anyone who's familiar with achievements from Xbox, well, these are pretty standard. I mean, you know, it's cool, and you know, there's often some. I'm not seeing any of the really stupid. Some games have really stupid achievements, and I'm not seeing any here, but. It does seem that. Well, this is weird. Complete the game on normal difficulty, 50 gamer score. Complete the game on legendary difficulty, 50. That's 100 for normal and 50 for legendary.
That's pretty weak.
That's weird.
50 for hero, 50 for legend, and 100 for normal. Weird.
I do like Kiltacular. Kill 4 opponents within 4 seconds. How do you do that with a rocket launcher or something?
Must be.
Yeah, I think in the game Crackdown, there was one where you had to kill X number of people in a short time, and it was just like an explosive that you can use. But if you're a completist, or you know, if you're excited about achievements, check out the list, and this might be a reason for you to upgrade to Vista and get Halo 2.
And maybe get yourself in the Guinness Book of World Records.
That's right, because now, apparently, there's going to be a Guinness Book of World Records just for video games. So I'm sure the guy who's like the world champion at Pac-Man, who played the perfect Pac-Man game, he'll probably be in that. But what other type of world records can we think of?
They're those things where people beat Super Mario Brothers 3 in 11 minutes.
Speed runs.
That'd be awesome. Yeah, like for Quake.
I love those.
Know, Quake done quick and Quake done quicker.
Totally.
But I think that the Super Mario Brothers one, at least, I think turned out to be something of a hoax, because what it was somebody running it on an emulator.
And just freeze framing it.
Yeah, every time they screwed up, they could rewind. to like the save a half second before.
Well, that's one thing Guinness is pretty good at, is verifying the achievements. So hopefully they can apply that to video games.
To get an achievement, like in the,
record
in the Guinness Book of World Records, you have to have like two spectators and some type of official judge. And I wonder if they'll be doing that, or if they'll have retroactive, you know, records for games. I don't know. The Guinness Book of World Records has kind of changed back from what I remember. It used to be this kind of like almanac type of book, and now it's this like coffee table book.
I used to have the old Guinness books when I was a kid, and they were almost like big encyclopedias, and now I think they've been dumbed down somewhat. So the addition of a video game version is all part of the same trend, I think.
I would hope anyway that they still have all of the information that would be in a big encyclopedia, but they're just editorially selecting the more interesting stories to put in the
Guinness Book. It's just inherently not as interesting, though, is it? Because you know, like the most, you know, the world's stickiest booger or whatever, or the guy that managed to cram the most bumblebees into his face. You know, the most of those are so perverse or so athletically impressive or whatever that that's what makes it fun. But like the guy who beat Super Mario World the most number of times, like I really couldn't care less.
Maybe they'll come up with some good worst cat ass. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, I imagine that some of the longest, continuous marathon gaming sessions will be in there as well.
Well, it would be cool to be in the book. I don't know how cool it would be to read it.
I don't think it would be cool to be in the book. It's not something I would shout from the
rooftops. The biggest loser of all this.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder though if they will include those marathon gaming sessions, because every so often you hear the guy out of China who keeled over and died after one of those, and Guinness doesn't do things that endanger your health. They cut out like drinking contests and stuff like that because people would try and beat it and get alcohol poisoning.
That's silly. Drinking contests never killed
him. I saw an awesome movie last year about the guy who has like one of the top 10 scores in Missile Command, and he played for like 40 hours straight. And I met the guy, and he's totally. But you know, he knew how to take breaks and have cigarettes and food while he was playing the game.
Thank God he stopped to smoke.
Exactly. he knew how to maintain his sanity. The people who die playing these games just aren't, they've lost it.
No, I think that's funny.
You've been playing
for, you say you play video games for 40 hours straight. I hope you stop to smoke regularly. Jeez.
Yes. Think about your health.
Yeah, hopefully you stop doing one unhealthy activity long enough to do another. That's all I have.
All right, well, coming up, we have an interview with Mark DeForest, who is the lead designer of Savage 2, the sequel to the popular action FPS/RTS hybrid. So we'll be back with that. Stay tuned.
Okay, so we're here with Mark DeForest, co-founder and lead designer of Savage 2, the sequel I guess it was 2003 that game came out. Is that right, Mark?
Yep.
And Savage 1, can you tell us a little bit about that? I guess not a whole lot of people are familiar with it. I personally saw my roommate in college was a big fan of it, but I didn't really get into that. I was absorbed in Star Wars Galaxies at the time, so that dominated me. But can you give us a little refresher?
Yeah, Savage 1 was a game where it was an online-only multiplayer game that melded together two games into one, with two teams going at it. Each team had a commander. That commander played a game very similar to common and popular RTSs. The difference being that instead of controlling AI units on the ground, those units were actually being played by human beings, which brings you to the other side of the game where you're playing a traditional action FPS type of game with strategy elements of base building and having somebody have a bird's eye view of the battlefield, giving you instructions and directions.
Right, it's set in a fantasy world where one side is beasts and one side is humans?
Yep, that is correct. Set in a post-apocalyptic world that didn't have much of a medieval feel, but definitely had kind of the lush green feel of a medieval game, but was more kind of sci-fi based with a little bit of fantasy in the side of the beasts, magic, and nature. The game that kind of inspired me to come up with the core design for Savage One was a game called Allegiance. It was a kind of a space sim game that had the role of a commander. And it wasn't so much a traditional RTS type of a game, but it had the elements of strategy where building and deploying workers and researching technologies took place. And then, rather than being units on a battlefield, wielding a sword or a gun, it was ships. And the game created, for me and a lot of my friends, the most epic and exciting battles that, until Savage One, I had ever experienced in playing a multiplayer game, and it was kind of something that, a lot like Savage, it never really caught on to mass appeal, but even to this day, still has a cult following, kind of like Savage 1 does.
So yeah. let's actually talk about Savage 2 then. So what's different about this new version?
That's a good segue going back to the comment that I made about both Allegiance and Savage 1 having a cult following but never really hitting mass appeal. I have a feeling that we have a good idea of why Savage 1 didn't hit appeal. One, the game was released too early, so it didn't have the polish that it should have. And there was also some minor balance issues, and most importantly, the complexity of the game. Not so complex that it's impossible to learn, but it's definitely a different kind of game. And we didn't present it to players in a way that allowed for people to quickly and easily pick up on it. So you combine that with lack of necessary polish, and it's really hard to get players to see through some of the issues, to get past the learning curve, and then really enjoy the game for what it is. In Savage 2, by identifying those things and then hopefully coming up with fixes for those that include shipping the game with a tutorial, having a ton of hints and explanations of the game come up while it's installing, and then really polishing the game to be just to the extent, I mean, we have the highest set of expectations for what we expect of polish and interface to explain everything that's happening in a game while you're playing the game. So you can actually, even outside of hints and tutorials, you can really learn how to play the game just from the feedback that you get from within the game.
For someone listening who's never played Savage 1, what is going to be their experience going into Savage 2? Like, what are they going to get out of it? And, you know, what kind of things are they going to see?
Well, most players we'll play the game in an FPS action-type setting. Now, in Savage 2, we incorporated more elements of RPG, being spellcasting. But for spellcasting, leveling, gathering items, purchasing items. But for us, the most important thing in our game design is skill, and that's the ability to aim and maneuver to evade death and gain kills. So everything that we've done in the game, including spellcasting, don't think of like a traditional RPG or massive multiplayer game where you just click on a unit and cast a spell on it. You actually have to aim at them. Now, we've done some stuff with aim assisting and feedback to know if you're going to successfully cast a spell on somebody, whether it be a buff or a debuff or a direct damage spell. It still requires some skill, and it keeps the excitement and action orientation of the game up. I mean, what you're going to experience is really a game that starts out at a good pace, but then feverishly gets faster and faster and faster, and battles without being too overdrawn, because we put some good measures in place that will have a very epic feel to them, where ultimately the two teams fight to destroy each other's main buildings.
Looking at your website, I saw the behemoth in there.
Yep.
That guy has some pretty impressive bump mapping and stuff, showing all the cracks in his skin. But yep. Can you talk a little bit about how he plays into the gameplay?
Absolutely. The behemoth is a siege unit for the beasts. Both sides have to deploy one form of a siege weapon to take down the main building. You can attack buildings using a regular unit, using their handheld weapons or their ranged weaponry, but it's just not that effective against the armor of a building. So siege units are something that you deploy and protect on their way to the enemy base, and then either make attempts to take down key buildings that provide certain technologies and units for each team, or just go straight for the command center, the main building, which would be a lair for the beast, or a stronghold for the humans. And he uses a uprooted tree. He's about 3.5 times taller than the average unit in the game, so he has a real big wow factor. And he uses the tree, and he slams the tree into the building and attempts to take it down.
So if I want to play as a behemoth, what do I have to do to get to that point?
To get a behemoth, your commander would have to build a number of buildings to make a charm shrine available. Once the charm shrine is available and built, then you can purchase a behemoth. You earn gold in the game by killing other units or by killing NPCs, or actually doing damage to a unit. There's a formula that we use that when a unit dies that you've done damage to, there's a bonus to the last hit given to the person making the kill blow, and then the rest of the gold that unit gives off is divided to the people who have done damage to it. So anyways, you earn gold in the game. You purchase the behemoth. You spawn from either a forward-built sub-layer or your layer at your main base, and you slowly maneuver. It's one of the downfalls of a behemoth. You slowly maneuver towards the enemy structure that you want to take down and hit it.
How big are the maps? I mean, how far do I have to travel to get to the enemy base? I mean, if I'm escorting a siege unit for, like, I don't know how long it takes from one side to the other, it could get a little boring, but how do you tune that, and how does that relate to map size?
Well, map size is generally related to how many people we expect to play in the map. If you're going to have a small amount of people, and we wanted to make it so that traveling around the map, just as you said, is not boring. So in the event that you're going to have, you know, around 30 players on a team, then the map is fairly large. If you were to just spawn and walk from your stronghold to their stronghold, it might take 3.5 to 4 minutes. The advantage of a big map is there's going to be a lot of players on it. So, and not only are there going to be a lot of players on it, but these structures that I talked about, these forward-built garrisons or sub-layers, garrisons for the humans, sub-layers for the beasts, allow you to spawn closer to the action. On top of that, officers, those would be the people who lead the squads in the game, who are determined by the commander for each team, they can place down a spawn flag, which one hit kills a spawn flag, and there's a fairly decent amount of time, of cooldown time to build one, but you can spawn on your officers. Every player in the game is in the squad. You can always spawn on your officer's spawn flag. So things like that allow for, you know, the action to always be there, but on smaller maps, like the map that we test the game on internally right now, takes about 1 minute and 25 seconds to walk from edge to edge. But you would never want to put 30 people on that server because as fun as it is to have a lot of people fighting all the time, it's actually too much. So
one thing about games like this where you have one player commanding other players, at least with Battlefield 2, it's like the people who are on the ground fighting have very little incentive to actually do what they're told. I mean, a lot of the time they'll go off and do something on their own. Have you come up with any way to incentivize them to actually follow orders?
Obviously, in high-level play, people will listen to what their commander does, probably because they'll know their commander, they'll have faith in what their commander's telling them to do. When you get into just the general population of players playing in pubs, it is extremely difficult to get them to follow orders. Some of the things that we've instituted to help in that regard is we have experience bonuses for being near your officer. We have experience bonuses for complying with a command. You get regeneration bonuses by being around your officer. We also keep persistent statistics on every player. Like, for example, when you're setting up a game, or even if you join a game that's in progress, you can see your commander's overall skill factor, overall experience, and the commander wins and losses, which may allow you to have a little more faith in what they're asking you to do. We also put a lot of importance on the win percentage in a player's account for ranking them. So winning the game is important to you, if seeing that your commander knows what they're doing, and if getting experience bonuses by doing what you're told to help you do what you're asked to do, then hopefully, you know, it'll motivate people to do just that. Obviously, you don't want to give the commander too much control over forcing people to do stuff, because nobody wants to play a video game where they feel like they're forced to do something that someone else wants them to do. That's kind of why people play video games, to get out of real life. But, I mean, we hope that those things help.
And you're adding RPG elements to this one, right? People are gaining experience. What does the experience go towards?
Yeah, in Savage 1, we did have experience. It was kind of bland. It was actually more of a visualization thing as you gained levels. In this game, everybody starts out when you enter a match at the same level. It's level 1. You can level all the way up to 15. Every time you gain a level, you gain 3 attribute points that you can spend. And those attributes range from increasing your melee damage, increasing your range damage, increasing your melee attack speed, you're increasing your armor, your health, mana, stamina, and the regeneration of all of those. So we never want to make it to the point where a level 15 guy is so overpowered that you can't enter a game and kill him. Again, the number one motivation in our game design is skill. But it just kind of makes it fun, and definitely you can't put all your points in one pool, so you can't just become some hit point monster, and you can't just become some massive damage dealer. So it allows for some balance, but it also allows for people who like to be healers, for example, can put more of their points into mana and mana regeneration, because they know that's, you know, kind of what they're going to focus on. It just allows for a little more specialization. And, I think everybody agrees that it's pretty fun to just kind of alter your character. And the fact that that's not persistent, and that when you join a new game, you start all over from scratch again, it doesn't make that big of a difference, but it's just another factor of fun.
Okay, and so you're self-publishing this game rather than working with a publisher, and that, I guess, that'll let you put it out when you think it's ready?
Exactly.
Right, and distribute online as well?
Yep. We are self-published. We're distributing this digitally only. It makes sense. It's an online multiplayer game. The big advantage of that is, we get to continue to work on the game, even though we've got a lot of fans that, you know, are begging for us to finish it. But we want to finish it when it's right, and in the end, that'll be best. It'll add for more players. And it also allows us to charge what we think is a responsible price to people who want to buy the game, and make decisions around our software that are more oriented towards a gamer rather than trying to protect this asset. And a lot of the things that we've done by allowing the game files to be downloaded at any time on any PC for free, and try out the tutorial and have free, absolute no obligation, free game time, and play the game at LAN parties. You don't even need an account to play it at a LAN party. Anybody can play it for free. Are just some of the things that, you know, being in the position that we are allows us to do, and we hope in the end it helps us become even more successful.
Yeah, it sounds like it'll be really great. Are you planning on doing a open beta or a demo before release?
I don't know if we'll ever switch to an open beta, but when the game is actually released, yeah, there's the way it works is you have to have an account to play the game online. You can play a game. We haven't finalized it. It'll be minor nagware into probably minor increases in the spawn times after you die. And then you'll have X number of game time free. So you'll be able to play the game for 3 to 5 hours before it says, okay, your demo's expired. You can purchase an account for $29.99 right in the game and keep going in the action. Or you can come back at any time that you've created an account and purchase and continue to play online.
Right. And what's your, about, you know, generally speaking, what kind of release date are you looking at?
Summer.
All right. We're looking forward to it. And we'll be getting in the game shortly. And so be looking for some hands-on coverage from us soon. All right. Thanks a lot for your time,
Mark. Excellent. Thank you, guys.
Alright, so that's it for the interview. Let's jump right into the playlist. Dan, what have you been playing this week?
I've been playing the Go on Vacation to Hawaii game.
Oh, how was that?
It was a lot of fun, but didn't play any video games unless you count getting sunburned, which is really not a video game.
Did you admire the real-world physics of the waterfalls and the
beach? Yeah, it looked almost as good as
Crysis. Refractive lighting? Oh, almost.
I don't know what's wrong with you. I played WarioWare in Tahiti.
Yeah, that's what handhelds are for. Jeez.
The only handheld gaming platform I own is my original 1989 Game Boy.
Nothing wrong with that. I've still got my original 1989 Game Boy, and it's still got the original Tetris cartridge.
Likewise.
Pretty much fused into it.
You don't need any other game.
You really don't.
Yeah. Logan, what have you been playing?
Well,
aside from, you know, Peggle.
Hey, nothing wrong with a
right
little
now.
Peggle action. Oh, well, I blew a tire going at 90 miles an hour down I-80. Scariest thing that ever happened to me in my life. I had about 150 mini heart attacks in a split second.
Wait, when did this happen?
This happened yesterday.
Wow.
It sounded like somebody was standing on my bumper with a shotgun, blew my right rear tire out, smoke everywhere, slam on the hazard lights. Everyone starts veering away from me. I thinking, okay, do I ram against the center divider? Because it's hard to brake going that
fast. Were you still able to control the car?
Barely. It kept wanting to veer to the right, but that was where traffic was because I was in the fast lane. So my option was to go to ram against the center divider or hope everyone got out of my way, which they did. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, if you're out there. Pulled over to the side of the road, hair raising, sat there, had 150 more heart attacks, waited for a tow truck to arrive. They took a look at it and they said, we're going to need a new tow truck. They had to put in a flatbed because the tire was just shredded.
Oh.
And they couldn't even tow it that way. So while I waited for the flatbed, I pulled out my handy pocket PC and played Call of Duty 2 on my pocket PC. I was very skeptical. But you know what? It was actually a lot of fun. Nice experience sitting there right in my car. Blam, 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 blam. You know, sometimes shooting actually gets your blood pressure down. And it was a nice thing to have there. So to all the folks at Aspyr, good job. You can check it out at aspyr.com if you just happen to have a pocket PC, and I hope that you do.
Did you get any cell phone pics or anything?
Of the tire?
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's a wreck. It was unbelievable.
You should post that on the blog.
And I would have had to have crashed against the center divider if everyone hadn't. Well, I mean, they had to get out of my way. There was an incredible amount of smoke. And all the steel came. Oh, yeah, okay, it blew. So the explosion was so bad that somehow, you know the mud flaps that hang right below your tires in front of it?
Mm-hmm.
That mud flap, the hard rubber, is bent at about a 45-degree angle toward the tire. I have no idea how it happened. But
man, that could have been a lot worse. You could have spun out or anything.
If I was on the icy road that I had been on an hour earlier, I would have spun out. I would have rolled easily. Because I've got a Jeep-shaped thing, you know? and those roll really easily. If I'd been turning or at an angle, I would have wrecked. So believe me, even though it cost me $15 a mile to tow me back to San Francisco, 35 miles,
jeez.
I was kissing the ground. I will not whine about paying hundreds and hundreds of dollars to get my ass back home because, woo, it would have been taps for Logan.
We're glad you're okay.
Thank you. I'll be here all week.
All right, Gary?
I've been playing Peggle. I've been playing a lot
of
Peggle.
That's not what I heard. I heard you've been playing something else.
I've been playing a lot of well, give me a minute here. I've been playing a lot of things. First of all, I've been, you know, I'm so tired of like having to kind of bluff my way through the playlist because I haven't been playing very many PC games. I've been playing a load of them this week, so I'm going to have my moment in the sun here. Peggle is, of course, brilliant, and if you haven't downloaded it yet, you should go to popcap.com/Peggle and check it out because it's so much fun. I got
the attitude I was hearing a couple weeks ago.
What?
Before he played it.
Circumspect about the whole Peggle scene.
Well, you know, it's one of those many things that sounds kind of silly in theory, but you give it a try.
So I want to hear you say, "I take it back."
I take what back? What did I say about Peggle?
You
said
mean things about Peggle.
What did I say?
Logan's oversensitive.
It started with bah, you know, and then went downhill from there.
I admit that I was dismissive of the concept before I had a chance to play it, but now that I've played it, yeah, it's fantastic. I'm onto kind of the more advanced challenge levels now, which are really, really kicking my ass and giving me a hard time. But yeah, it's such a great game to pick up just for, you know, 10, 15 minutes at a time when you want, you know, you don't necessarily have a lot of time to play, but you want to get some gaming goodness in there for the day. So that's been good. But the real time sink for me, this past week has been Command & Conquer 3. I've been waiting for this game, not necessarily this particular game, but I'm waiting for a game like this to come back really since probably the last Red Alert. You know, the return of the kind of the unapologetically old school RTS is something that pleases me immensely. I mean, the game has really not evolved very much at all to the point at which what few RTS skills I used to have, which are all kind of uniquely tied to the Command & Conquer games, they're all kind of coming back now. And while I suck at most other RTSs, I actually have racked up a few wins with Tiberium Wars. So I've been enjoying that a lot. It doesn't hurt that it's got like all my favorite TV hotties in the cinematic sequences, like that dude from Lost. He's dreamy.
It's Sawyer.
No, the Boomer from Battlestar Galactica and the hot chick from House. You know, it's like they had access to my dreams or something when they decided to cast us. What's that?
You left out Trisha Helfer from that?
She's all right, but I don't like her as much as the other two.
Yeah. Oh, you've read Playboy, you've seen it all.
She's a much better
actor. Hey, are there cinematics for the screen campaign?
They're all CG. They don't have any actors.
Okay. Well, I'm enjoying it a lot. I think I'm coming towards the end of the GDI campaign. I just started the Nod campaign. I spent the whole week trying to beat this one bitch of a GDI mission, which apparently has been giving people a lot of trouble.
I know exactly which one you're talking about.
Do you know which one I'm talking about?
Guys.
What's that?
You don't want to get IMIS. Watch that language.
Sorry.
No, it's the one where you have to defend
the base and then escort the MCV and then build up your base and take out the three Nod bases. So hard.
Took me several attempts to beat that one.
It took me a lot of attempts, and I finally beat it today, so that's good. And I've been playing some online games with some people that I know from online and having a lot of fun there. So I'm loving it. And then the third thing I just kind of started trying out yesterday is Lord of the Rings Online, the open beta. It's remarkably easy to get into. You just download the client, and they give you a key, and you can play, I think, for 2 weeks. You can level up to level 15. But I still don't know if I'm ready to play an MMO that is kind of like Warcraft, but it's not Warcraft. I mean, you can look at all the elements. It's like, yeah, go kill six of these things, and, you know, I'll give you some gloves. Yeah, I would feel like it's so hard for me to transition from one game that I'm deeply invested in into another one. I kind of feel like I'm starting all over again. And well, so it's very pretty.
A new character.
It's got nice graphics, but it takes itself way too seriously. And I think that's partly to do with them having to please the Tolkien estate and it all having to be very serious. You know, you have to, you don't have to, but they strongly suggest that, you know, your name has to be kind of like a Tolkien type name in the game. You have to, you know, follow along with all the all the kind of the lore conventions of the Tolkien world. And there's no PvP. Well, none to speak of anyway. And that just is crazy.
I can't be a hobbit named Poopmaster.
You can be a hobbit, but I don't know if you try to, you know, give yourself a stupid name, I don't know if it will let you do it or not. When you pick your race, it gives you a little screen that tells you all the various types of names that it's going to suggest for you. All the various different kind of phenomes and things that, you know, you're supposed to construct an appropriate sounding name from. So if you wanted to create a hobbit called Jazzy McBullwinkle or whatever, I don't know, that sounds kind of good actually, but I don't think it will let you do that, because that's not, you know, Tolkien would turn in his grave or something.
Back to Season 3, I think we want to get Gaz and Dan playing against each other, so you guys...
No, that's crazy.
I was just going to challenge you to a fight to the death.
I would get owned.
Well,
by Dan.
Yeah,
I haven't played in a week, Gaz.
We can do 2v1. It'll be me and you versus Dan. And
okay, I might be willing to do that.
Yeah,
he'll still beat
you. You can
Dan is just too good at RTS games.
You've been playing for nonstop for a week. I haven't been playing at all.
Yeah, but I think you've got an inherent level of skill and familiarity with RTS strategies that I think trumps that.
But it's CNC. There's no real strategy to it.
Well, I would take issue with that.
But you want to play SubCom? There's strategy there. In CNC, it's so fast paced that there's no real time for strategy.
I don't think that's true at all.
It would still be fun. We'll get that set up, and then we'll put that Battlecast recording online on the podcast website.
That's one thing that I want to say about CNC 3. I love that Battlecasting thing where you can have a commentator and telestrating, and you can tape delay the games. It's a really, really cool feature.
Here's what we should do. We should have Gaz and I play, and Norm can commentate.
All right, we'll talk about it.
Dan, it won't last 2 minutes.
Well, those games
then it won't be that
short,
big waste of your time.
Do you even have it installed yet?
I do.
Okay, well, I'm ready whenever you are.
All right.
Right after this podcast. All right, Jeremy, what are you playing?
Peggle, and I've also checked out GameTap, which is actually kind of neat, and it's a 99-cent for the first month right now, so it's, you know, nothing to try out.
And you have 1,000 games at your disposal.
Yeah, including some old DOS classics, which are running great, which I was really surprised by. But I'm also pressing play on a lot of the Breakpoint demo releases that were released last weekend. If you're at all into the demo scene or tech demos, you should definitely check some of these out, especially Debris by Farbrouch, which is
oh,
just...
Oh, yeah. Awesome. You posted that on the comment section. We all checked it out in the office.
Yeah.
It was amazing. It's 177K. It has a full soundtrack and this incredible sequence that's, you really have to see it to believe it. And
I don't understand how that can be 177K.
It's procedural methods. It's the thing that Will Wright talks about. Yeah, it's the thing that Will Wright talks about.
I was talking to Will Smith about this today. He said if you check the, Will Smith from Maximum PC, he says if you check the directory.
Yeah, because for a minute there, I seriously thought you were chatting to your buddy, Hollywood A-lister Will Smith.
The Fresh Prince.
About the demo scene.
Yeah. Anyway.
Thanks for clarifying that for us.
Not everyone on this podcast knows Will Smith. Anyway, so I was talking to him about it. He says if you check the directory that it extracts to, when you run it, it pops up with this white bar that takes a couple minutes to go across for the loading. He says if you check the directory, it comes out to about 300 megs because it actually creates the content procedurally.
Yeah.
And then
wow. So but you have to appreciate those procedural methods that it takes to make that.
I've actually
used the tool that they use, a precursor to the current tool that they're using, because they release these tools online free. Anyone can download these and experiment and try to make a production like that yourself. And it's awe-inspiring once you get your hands on that tool to see what these guys have done with it, because all you have are primitives, like squares and cubes and basic shapes and things you can transform them with. And they build everything, all the textures from scratch, just using those basic elements. And, you know, one step after another, 200 steps later, you have the texture of a brick wall.
It is very impressive.
It's very cool.
Yeah, although those texture techniques wouldn't work for character models. This is only good for environments, really.
Well, not necessarily true. That's what I was saying. Will Wright's using these procedural methods to create the characters for Spore, and that's why
to create the textures, and animations.
Exactly, yeah. But also the modeling and the animations, because that's why he was saying each of those characters are just a few K to upload, and he actually hired several demo sceners to create the technology to do that.
Right, I'm just saying that if you wanted to make like a human face, you couldn't do it using that kind of thing. You couldn't you would need a pretty big library of resources to pull from.
You should check out the demo that same group released 5 years ago. Yeah, 64K with a walking human figure.
Well, a figure, yes, but how is it textured?
Oh, no, it's not very well textured.
That's what I'm talking about, the textures.
Gotcha.
All right. Let's settle this fight. So I've been playing Peggle. Oh, Peggle. I hate you guys so much. And actually, I played a little bit of Cell Factor this past week, which is that physics, the geophysics game. It's kind of cool. I'll be writing a column about that in an upcoming issue. And Guitar Hero for Xbox 360 has been
consuming love that.
80% of my time these days. My fingers hurt. Literally.
I've seen you on my friends list on there a couple of times, and Wiedemann's up there as well. He's got some high scores.
Greg, who never plays his 360, I've seen more of him online this past week than...
He's been waiting for that game. He spent a lot of time over at my house playing it when it was just out on PS2, because he didn't have a PS2, but he was anxiously waiting. You know, as guitarist that he is, it's very much up his street, and he's very good at it too. I mean, you know, if you are a good guitarist, it does, I think, translate to a large extent into success at that game.
Do you guys think the sound packs are overpriced?
I think they're way overpriced.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that they're overpriced. If you think of it as, you know, you pay 99 cents on iTunes for a song, to get basically the same version of that song but with all the tabulation and the cover version and the licensing and the lead guitar and the bass guitar tabulations all separated out, 4 difficulty levels, I would happily pay $1.99. for songs like that, but I think it needs to be more of an iTunes model where I can just, you know, buy a la carte the songs that I want rather than having to buy kind of lame song packs of like 3 at a time, which, you know, I may not be interested in one or two of the songs on there. Maybe I just want one of those songs.
If it was the original artist, I think I would agree with you, but since it is a cover band, I expect to pay a little less.
It's the original artist in a couple of examples, but there's no way around, you know, way around that, unless you're going to get Aerosmith to kind of come into the studio and re-record their song.
They're doing it for Rock Band. All the songs for Rock Band are going to be the
original.
That's
because they have labels signed on, and I'm sure there's a lot of money.
Yeah, that's a much bigger enterprise. I mean, who knows? Maybe they've already announced Guitar Hero 3 for the fall. Maybe that'll also have a higher contingent of artists. The thing is, now that the USB peripheral is out there, I wonder if they have any interest in doing a PC version.
I think definitely, because it works with a PC, and that was something we didn't get to today. You can plug in the 360 guitar into a PC, and it works with the homebrew stuff, Frets on Fire. It recognizes as a gamepad, and you can configure the keys. There's actually a video online of someone playing Halo 2 for Vista with just the Guitar Hero 2 controller.
But
do you think it would be successful on PC? Because it's a bit of a different experience, isn't it? You know, like we've talked about this before, you know, it's one thing to be rocking out in your living room with friends or whatever in front of the big screen TV, but, you know, are people going to plug this into the PC in their den and rock out?
360 is right next to my PC, so I'm sitting in the same chair, I'm standing in the same area where I am, right in front of the same computer monitor when I play.
And you know, Gaz, I am almost certainly not going to play this because I have no rhythm whatsoever. But I did just go on Woot last night and splurge on a 42-inch Westinghouse monitor.
Nice, nice.
Oh, so, you picked up one of those? Nice.
Yeah. That's the one I want so bad.
I actually really want Dan to play Guitar Hero so he can come back on the podcast and try and explain to us how it would be better with a mouse and keyboard.
All right. On that note, we're going to end the show. We're running a little long this time. Sorry we didn't get to your questions, but if you have a question you want us to answer, you can send us a text question or an MP3 question. Just send an email to pcgamerpodcast@gmail.com. Check out our website, pcgamerpodcast.com, or subscribe to the magazine at pcgamer.com/subscribe. This is the PC Gamer staff signing off. Interview. Shut up.
Hey, Imus has just had his radio show pulled.
Yeah,
it's all over.
Ah,
there's now a new ugliest person in radio, I guess.
I don't know how to bring it back from the Q&A.
Well, there will be a thing with the stuff.
Music.
Yeah, there'll be a
the thing with the notes and the chords. Right. What is that called?
Yeah, and then Norm will say, let's do playlists.